Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with a quick recommendation. Every holiday weekend comes with a lot of waiting, traffic, airport security lines. And so while you're waiting, why don't you just binge on How I Built This? Each episode, I speak with a founder of a company who has an incredible story of how it all began. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. For the last 2 years, only one network comedy other than Modern Family has been nominated for an Emmy Award for Outstanding Comedy Series, and that's Black-ish. Created by Kenya Barris, the show draws its title from the concern that affluence might interfere with cultural identity.
I guess for a kid from the hood, I'm living the American dream. The only problem is, whatever American had this dream probably wasn't where I'm from. And if he was, he should have mentioned the part about how when brothers start getting a little money, stuff starts getting a little weird.
The show stars Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ellis Ross as Andre and Rainbow Johnson. They have five kids, plus Andre's mother and father, played by Jennifer Lewis and Lawrence Fishburne, are never far away. In this clip, the Johnson family runs through the rules of their favorite board game.
This is Black Monopoly, so let me break down the rules for you, all right? No side coaching, no gifting of money, but loans are allowed.
Just know you're never gonna get your money back.
You cannot collect rent while you're in jail, yep. And Pops does not pay income tax.
Reparations.
While the kids are precocious and the grandparents do crack wise, the show also spends significant time on issues like school segregation, postpartum depression, and in this fall's season premiere, the Juneteenth holiday that commemorates the official end of slavery. Here to talk to us about Black-ish is NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
And also joining us are the co-hosts of the Gimlet Media podcast, The Nod, Brittany Luce and Eric Eddings. Hi, guys.
Hey. Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. It's so good to have you back on the show.
We're happy to be
here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we heard that clip, the first clip of Anthony Anderson talking about, getting money and things getting weird. How did it strike you guys when you heard sort of the premise of Black-ish?
I wouldn't say it actually struck me as odd. I mean, interestingly enough, I think over history, there are a lot of Black sitcoms that tackle
class ascension.
Yeah.
Yeah. And relative affluence. That didn't strike me as the most interesting thing about the show. I think in this particular setting, the way they actually showcase that affluence is a lot more clear than some other shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was really interesting. I was always shocked at how detailed the depictions of class and how they intersect with class were.
Yeah. How about you, Brittany?
I think because I so grew up with a Fresh Prince and
right.
The Cosby Show, and even the Jeffersons, mm-hmm. the idea of Black people gaining wealth and then things getting kind of weird is kind of familiar territory. But one thing that I liked about Black-ish that kind of reminds me a little bit more of Fresh Prince than other Black family sitcoms, they acknowledge that the family has a lot of money.
Yes.
And why.
Yes.
It's not one of them, has, it's not like one of them is a teacher and the other one is a cop.
Right.
We don't know where this money came from.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? They make it very clear that they have, worked really, really hard,
right.
That they're really enjoying the fruits of their labor. And then also, too, there's, a lot more talk about, where they came from, having, Rainbow and Dre's backgrounds being different, and also having, the parents around, too, and, the kids as sort of, opposite ends of a spectrum where sort of Bo and Dre find themselves in the middle. There's a lot more open talk about class on the show that I think is a little bit closer to real life and kind of refreshing.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why some of the stuff that the show does about race is more interesting and direct, because they are so direct about the class stuff and the wealth stuff, that in some of these episodes, the school segregation episode is one, because they acknowledge how much money the family has, and because they talk openly about that, they can make a more specific point about public schools. And yes, it's a public school that's a lot nicer than some public schools, but there are still big differences between public schools based on, tons of different factors, and all the stuff about putting your kids in private school and the conflict between thinking that you have some obligation to put your kid in private school to give them the best possible situation, sort of contrasted with when everybody does that, you wind up with all the people with resources being pulled out of public schools, mm-hmm. which, of course, is a real thing. But the other thing I wanted to ask you, Stephen, is to me, I find it interesting that this show is innovative in a bunch of different ways. And yet it also has a very classic kind of sitcom structure. The dad is sort of a goofball, although the mom is also a goofball, yeah. which is one of the things I like about it. Well, how does that strike you as a kind of guy who's watched a lot of sitcom dads?
Yeah, I mean, I think my chief complaint about this show is that I'm not quite into Anthony Anderson. I tend to find him to be a little bit of like that doofy sitcom dad, and I'm very sensitive to that as a dad.
As a real-life sitcom dad.
As a real-life sitcom dad. And as somebody who was, for a number of years, a single dad, very, very sensitive about dads being portrayed as kind of these oafs.
Yeah.
And as this show has progressed, it's not only has it gotten more structurally innovative, but I feel like it's gotten away from some of that kind of traditional sitcominess. Like the Juneteenth episode that you mentioned, that has like a musical break and an animated break, and like they're able to kind of shake up that kind of traditional, like, dad says that things are like this, mm-hmm. but mom comes in and she disagrees. The more that it's gotten away from the everyday, the more interesting I find it, which is often the exact opposite of how I feel about sitcoms. Mm-hmm. I often feel about sitcoms like, whenever they, you know, like on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, when they get away from the precinct, I'm less interested.
Yeah.
This show, the more it strays from the basics of the family where Dre has a bunch of thoughts on something,
yeah.
The more it gets away from that, the more engaging I find it. And mm-hmm. it is able to do the quote-unquote very special episode in ways that are not only direct, as you guys said, but very, very poignant. I think they almost do very special episodes better than typical episodes.
Hmm.
I would actually agree with that. I mean, I think it's interesting though, because all of them are very special episodes.
Every episode of the season is a very special episode.
I do think this show has a very, very nice eye for detail. Before we step into the studio, Linda and I were talking about one of just my favorite little throwaway gags is when Junior, who's a very interesting sitcom character,
sort of their teenage son, who's kind of a nerd and also very well-intentioned premature adult.
The thing I like that Junior is like the kind of the classic, he's like the classic nerd. He hasn't undergone a transformation. There's sort of a push and pull where his family kind of resents him for being so weird, but they also don't want him to be any different than he is.
Yeah.
And he's also obsessed with his mother, which is one of my favorite characteristics about Junior and Rainbow's relationship, is that like he's obsessed with her. She's obsessed with him, but also, like, knows that it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
And the tension of that is so, 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 so good.
Yeah.
But the fact that we've spent this time grappling with what's the deal with Junior is one of the things that I love about that character, is that's not just, like, this kid is the this kid. This kid is the popular one. This one is the so-and-so. The fact that, like, Junior has all these little touches, like, wow, he got our phone number. He wears capes.
Yeah.
You know? or when he's trying to present himself as harder than he is. But he drops his iPod and it starts playing Fireflies by Owl City. I tend to gravitate more toward the supporting characters maybe than the central one.
I was going to say, I think that's really interesting too, because they've done an amazing job at characterization.
Oh my gosh.
Which is really remarkable in this particular case, because there are so many characters. Mm-hmm. They have a pretty broad ensemble, like when you bring in the grandfather and the grandmother, and in addition to all the kids that they have, in addition to Rainbow and Dre and the characters at work. So, like, to have all of them feel distinct and different and not just like there's some, like, Greek chorus who needs to, like, pop in and say, oh, this is the thing that it means, you know, is, like, really, really nice.
Yeah.
And you remember all those details, too, which is, like, just, for me, a little shocking. Like, nothing blends.
Yeah. I love all the little bits, like, so Dre's kind of buddy and coworker, Charlie.
Yeah.
Yes.
This relationship with Diane. The little daughter who's getting bigger, but they have this weird antagonistic relationship. Like she's constantly threatening him, and it sort of comes out of nowhere. It's not clear why. It's just that they are enemies. And so he's like a grown man and she's a little girl. Although she is the
precocious and maybe evil.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Well, and I love the fact that they have so much fun writing for those kids. Mm-hmm. And I will say I visited that set once. And when you talk to those people who work for that show, they are all so smart and thoughtful about what they're doing, whether it's Kenya Barris, who created it, or Anthony Anderson, or Tracy Ellis Ross, who I would watch this show just to see the way they style Tracy Ellis Ross on
this show.
Oh, my God.
She's so
fabulous. And she's so funny and wonderful. But also, all of the kids who play their children are bright and interesting and thoughtful. And we spoke to them, the critics that I was with, we spoke to them right after they had done the Juneteenth episode. Mm-hmm. And they were all just full of thoughts about it and how important it was and why they cared so much about doing it. And you're looking at them like, when I was the age that you are, I don't think I could possibly have appreciated all of this. And you throw in like Lawrence Fishburne and, oh my God, Jennifer Lewis. Oh. I mean, who doesn't love to watch Jennifer Lewis do literally anything?
She just chews up the script.
Every single time. Actually, last night, my boyfriend and I watched a 22-year-old Thanksgiving episode of Fresh Prince.
Oh, wow.
That was like, she was involved. Jennifer Lewis has played, she played one of Will's aunties. Mm-hmm. And there was this whole subplot about who makes the best dressing. She might have had 12 lines in the entire episode, and she might have been in half of two scenes. But like, wherever frame she steps into, she is the centerpiece. Like, it's all about her.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about the way that Dre and Bo kind of find themselves in between their parents and their kids, or his parents and their kids. But I also think there is stuff about affluence there in terms of what the kids expect versus how the parents think about money versus how the grandparents think about money. Mm-hmm. But there's also just what Ruby and Pops' experience was is so different from what the kids feel their experience will be.
They've done some things where the kids will show a sense of entitlement. There's an episode, I think it's the first episode of the third season, where they go to Disney World. Mm-hmm. And apart from the fact that it feels a lot like an episode-length advertisement for Disney World.
Typical to the ABC sitcom universe. Yeah. You get the family trip to Disney World, yeah.
Every single moment of it, I have the natural dad reaction of just thinking, how much does this cost?
Yeah, I looked it up at some point. It's a lot.
Yeah, but he wants to give his kids the VIP treatment at Disney World. And they do a nice job of the fact that the kids, over the course of this experience, develop a sense of entitlement.
Right.
The way you would, the way I would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also the way the show plays around with affluence and the different generations feeling toward what's available to them. And so the kids developing that sense of entitlement is an interesting facet of the show.
Yeah. And I love the fact that they drop in little, there's an episode this season that is about, or starts with Ruby being scammed in a, kind of like an email like that. Scam.
Oh, so good.
And all of a sudden there's this little drop that, you know, if you're 15 now and you watch this show, you might not recognize it as a direct reenactment of Trading Places. But it is. It is one. It's very reference heavy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is references that are dear to me, which I always appreciate, because what's better than that?
They had a really good reference. I think, was it season two? It was season one or season two. Charlie Dre's coworker. Yeah. Played by Dion Cole, who is so good, so good.
So funny.
I think he was trying to get back together with an ex, or he knew he was going to see an ex, and I can't remember who it was, but there was another character in the show who like encouraged him to like wear a white turtleneck and cry or something like that, but like wear a white turtleneck like a Nancy Myers heroine.
Sounds like Junior.
I was gonna say, I think it might have been Junior.
Yeah, it sounds like something Junior would say.
Sounds like something Junior would say. But yeah, I love Nancy Myers. Uh-huh, Eric hears this all the time.
I hear this literally all the time.
All the time. I'm obsessed with her. And the fact that, like, of all characters on the show, that Charlie was the one to wear like the Diane Keaton ribbed white turtleneck. Uh-huh. I was just like, just a deep appreciation for like the original thing, like a deep appreciation for something's gotta give.
Mm-hmm.
But like by just like, you could just see that in the selection of like which character got to enact that fantasy.
Yeah. Who's your favorite, Eric?
Oh, man. I think Diane is my favorite. The fact that she is possibly evil.
Y'all are the most alike, by the way.
Like, that's probably true, actually. But just, like, her ability to kind of manipulate the rest of the cast. Mm-hmm. Just, I identified with that a lot as the youngest child. She just has these moments where she plays off of Jack, and then she plays off of the rest of the siblings that are in the house, and she plays off of Charlie. Like, she's just so skilled at pulling out the little humor in every single interaction. Mm-hmm. Like, her relationship with Charlie, like, kind of going back to what you were saying, it's just, like, it's clearly, like, there's some piece of heartfelt. They enjoy tormenting.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And, like, I had some of those types of relationships. I mean, Brittany and I kind of have that relationship right now. And it means a lot. And it's so cool, like, seeing that represented in, like, what, a 12-year-old?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know how.
And Marseille Martin, she's so good.
Yeah.
She's so good.
And I always appreciate it, on a comedy in particular, when you can tell that one of the things that they're good at is seeing something that maybe they didn't anticipate and knowing that they should run with it. And I think that's one of those examples. I like the fact that these are parents who like their kids, enjoy their kids. The family, for the most part, enjoys being together. It's not, the entire show is not built on the idea that all these people can't stand each other and fight all the time or push each other around in a kind of like a nasty way. And I also like the fact that I feel like we went through a phase where, you know, family comedy was incredibly saccharine. Mm-hmm. And then there was a pushback where you got a lot of comedy kind of post Seinfeld that was very, very, very arch.
Yep.
And then you kind of got into single camera comedy, which was either really almost anti-comedy if it was on cable, or if it was like 30 Rock, it would be super joke-filled, but not very emotionally
warm or rich.
You know, not very emotionally rich, which is fine. I love 30 Rock, but that wasn't its thing.
Right.
I like the fact that this show is kind of threading all those needles where it's a single camera show, but it still feels jokey. It's still it's very joke heavy, and it has a lot of those just little jokes that just kind of skim by. And yet it's also really, not only does it have heft with regard to the family, but it does these things like that Juneteenth episode.
Yeah.
It's not just that they deal with race, it's that they deal with race in a really elevated, thoughtful way that is kind of a level past what broadcast television will often do when it's being like, this is our Black History Month episode.
It's also interesting that that was the first episode of the season.
Yeah.
Like, usually that's not the episode you lead with.
No.
A format breaker. Yeah.
Yeah. I said A for effort. I thought some of the execution was a little off.
Yeah.
But, like, all the things that happened within that, like, one 30-minute block was magnificent. The fact that you got, you know, the animated block, the singing, they took it back to kind of the workplace conversation between, you know, Dre and his coworkers, which is kind of like one of their key devices.
Right.
I thought it was really, really awesome. I mean, I think the only thing I wish that episode had done more that I think a lot of the other episodes that have followed it have kind of lived up to is kind of actually completing the narrative a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I liked that episode enough. Like, I think I agree with you, Eric, about the A for effort. I think that, like, just like the ambition of it.
Yeah. Right.
The ambition of it, and also, like, I think the sincerity of it. Speaking for myself, when you're a Black person and you make media that, like, more than 10 people can find, and sometimes even less, you feel this responsibility where you're like, okay, I have this platform. I know that this many people are going to, maybe it's 100,000 people, maybe it's 10,000 people, maybe in the case of Blackish, it's millions of people. I have these people's attention and I know that they trust me, and I'm going to, like, use my 22 minutes or whatever, however much time, to, like, really shoot my shot and try to get people to see this one really complicated thing way differently than they may have, you know, 22 minutes ago. And I loved that.
Yeah. And it's not only that it's an audience of millions of people, but, like, this is very interesting to me, right? Like, I thought this episode was, like, super interesting and full of, like, really, really, really interesting ideas. You guys both sort of feel like it is good. You know what I mean? I think part of the same phenomenon that you're talking about, which is they have an opportunity to put this episode in front of, like, millions of people, is they also have an opportunity to put it in front of a lot of white people who, like me, do not know as much about that stuff as you guys do.
No, totally. But I think that happens in many other ways. Like, for us, the Juneteenth episode was a little lukewarm in that they tried to, like, I knew about Juneteenth.
We talk about Juneteenth at work a lot.
Yeah.
Well, one, I haven't seen, other than Atlanta, I don't think I've seen Juneteenth really covered on TV.
Yeah, like no.
That, especially in that context. So I was really excited by that. But for me, I think I had a better relationship with the very special episode that covered postpartum depression. That was something that, like, I was really, really into. And I thought the way they kind of carried that narrative through, and even how they kind of ended on a, this isn't completely resolved note,
right.
like meant a lot, and was another, like, great opportunity that they had clearly, one that they had clearly cared a lot about.
Yeah.
And done it in a way that still felt super true to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I think my point being, I think everybody has that episode with Blackish.
No, that's
where
true.
Where they see this particular issue, they see the way they've covered it and the care that goes into all those different details, and they say, wow, this feels special.
Yeah, I think that's fair. All right, well, come and tell us what you think about Blackish. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lyft, reminding listeners that they could be relaxing in a Lyft ride right now with their eyes closed, listening to Beethoven or whale sounds or a babbling brook or something else relaxing. Lyft provides rides as relaxing as the buttery smooth voice of a public radio announcer, because riding is just a more relaxing way to drive. Lyft, it matters how you get there. Download and ride today.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Little Passports. Every month, kids can explore a new country when packages arrive in the mail filled with activities, souvenirs, maps, stickers, and more. Or try Science Expeditions, which delivers exciting hands-on experiments and STEM activities every month. Little Passports has subscriptions and gifts for kids of all ages. Find special offers for our listeners at littlepassports.com/popculture.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Blatant self-promotion of the other part of my NPR job. We are celebrating the 10th anniversary of NPR Music, launching that huge editorial package full of conversations about the last 10 years. It is an odd time to do a 10-year retrospective, the span from 2007 to 2017. Mm-hmm. You don't get a lot of decade-in-review packages that cover that kind of span. Uh-huh. But it's All Songs Considered is doing, for this week and next week, a daily podcast covering each year of those 10 years, mm-hmm. Which means that I got to participate in a discussion of Gangnam Style with several of my colleagues that went interesting places. it's just a fun and ambitious and at times silly and entertaining package that I'm really, really, really proud of. And of course, we're coming right up on the 10th anniversary of Tiny Desk Concerts, so we're about to do yet another retrospective. But the 10th anniversary of NPR Music, I've been there for all 10 years of it. That is making me happy.
Oh, thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Brittany Luce, what is making you happy right now?
Okay, so there's this British show that I've become obsessed with it recently, and it's called The Big Family Cooking Showdown.
Yeah, it is.
So you've seen it?
I have.
Oh, my God. Okay. This is making me so happy. Oh, my God. Basically, what happened is that the Great British Baking Show, great show, but then it went from BBC to Channel 4. So BBC wanted to get back at Channel 4 for taking the show, so they came up with The Big Family Cooking Showdown. Every episode, you have like two teams of three family members, and a lot of times it's intergenerational. Sometimes it's a child, a parent, and a grandparent. Sometimes it's like a boyfriend, a girlfriend, and one of the, you know, the girlfriend's mom. It's so cute, because you just get to see families cooking with each other on set, like in a studio competition setting, like cooking together as a family, like, but in a television setting. But then the second round of every episode of competition features a cooking at home challenge, where like the hosts and the judges come to the contestants' home.
Yes.
Yes. And then they get to watch that, like, then they cook as like a family and like serve them food that they really love inside their own home. And I just love it. The hosts, Zoe and Nadia, who is actually an alum of the Great British Baking Show.
That's right. She sure is.
She's adorable. They're so cute. They have great banter. And the judges, Giorgio and Rosemary, are amazing. The competition never gets nasty. I highly, highly, deeply recommend The Big Family Cooking Showdown. You will fall in love.
I agree. If you're missing your bake-off, this is the place to go. I agree. Thank you very much, Brittany. Eric Eddings, what is making you happy this week?
So I'm late to the party, but Fargo from FX, the FX series.
Nice.
I love this show. So the series is based off of the movie, or kind of like lives in the same world of the movie. Mm-hmm. I think there are three seasons now, and they kind of stretch out what would normally be for a Coen Brothers movie is like two hour-ish plot. They stretch it out for, you know, 13 episodes. And I actually didn't think that they were going to be able to kind of hold up with, you know, the consistency of the writing, the plot development, the character development, but they just get it so right. It is very violent, very dark, and I just watch it with glee. Like, I really, truly love it. I don't know what that says about me. Maybe going back to what Brittany said, maybe I am a touch evil. But but I just really, really enjoy it.
I'm a season behind, but the first two seasons are both excellent.
Yeah, just so well done.
Very good. Fargo on FX. Thank you, Eric. It is not only because Brittany and Eric are here that I am going to pick a Gimlet show as my what's making me happy this week, but I do want to bring to your attention that the second season of Heavyweight is now
so
out.
So
this is Jonathan Goldstein's show, which essentially is about people coming on to revisit some past event that was incredibly meaningful for them and to go back and try to kind of excavate what happened. Sometimes that's incredibly painful and awkward, but it's also often very interesting. Some of them are sort of funny, but a lot of them are quite serious. And I've been going through the episodes of the new season, but the one that I specifically want to highlight is called Christina. And it's about a woman who had a foster mother who told her she couldn't play basketball when she was in high school, and kind of ended her time as a high school basketball player. And she has always been upset about the fact that she was not able to continue and felt that it affected her life. So they go back to kind of talk to her foster mom, who's in her 90s, try to figure out what was she thinking when she asked her, when she told her she couldn't do this anymore, and talk to the two of them. And it's just, it's deceptively simple because it seems like it's kind of just go interview your old, you know, it's like if you went and interviewed your old Spanish teacher or something like that. But it's very, very satisfying and wonderful. And again, it's called Heavyweight. That is another Gimlet show. Brittany and Eric, for people who have not heard The Nod, what is The Nod, which is also a Gimlet show?
The Nod, like, I guess it, at its simplest, is reported stories about Black life and culture. But that is like a really big umbrella.
Yeah.
We've talked about a lot of things on the show.
We've talked about everything from Beyonce conspiracy theory videos on YouTube to like this small group of shoplifters and boosters who used to go in and steal Polo Ralph Lauren, and how they kind of cemented the relationship between Polo and hip hop.
The Nod, available at Gimlet. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Brittany Luce. Brittany, what's your Twitter handle?
It's at BM Luce, L-U-S-E.
And you can find Eric Eddings at E Eddings. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. This is great.
Thanks for listening. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more folks to find the show. And we will see you all back here next week.